Chapter 5. Screen 4, said Cress, squinting at the grid of icons. Hijack to D5. Without waiting for the animated gesture to cartwheel to his new space, she shifted her attention to the next game. Screen 5. Claim rubies and daggers, discard crowns. The screen sparkled, but she had already moved on. Screen 6. She paused, chewing on the tips of her hair. 12 rows of numbers filled up the screen, some slots left blank, some tinted with colors and patterns. After her brain twisted around an equation she wasn't sure she could have done a second time, the puzzle lit up before her, the solution as clear as a moonrise over Earth. 3A, insert yellow 4. 7B is black, 16. 9G is black, 20. The grid melted away, replaced with a second-era singer swooning into a microphone, the audience swelling with applause.
Congratulations, big sister, said little Cress. You won!
Cress's victory was short-lived. She rolled onto her side and reassessed the first game. Seeing the move that little Cress had made since her last turn squelched her pride, she'd backed herself into a corner. Screen 1, she murmured, swooping her hair over one shoulder and mindlessly knotting the dampened ends around her fingers. 5 knots later, and her victory on screen 6 was forgotten. Little Cress was going to win this one. She sighed and made the best move she could, but it was immediately followed by Little Cress's king moving to the center of the holographic labyrinth and claiming the golden chalice. A laughing jester appeared, gobbling down the rest of the game board. Cress groaned and pulled her hair off her neck, waiting for whatever task her younger self would randomly select for her.
I won,
said little Cress, once the holograph had disappeared back into the screen. The other games automatically locked themselves.
You now owe me 10 minutes of country western line dancing as guided by the following video, followed by 30 jump squats. Let's begin.
Cress rolled her eyes, wishing she hadn't been quite so perky when she recorded the voice. But she did as she was told, sliding off the bed as a mustached man in a large hat appeared on the screens, thumbs hooked into his belt loops. A couple years ago, upon realizing that her living accommodations offered few opportunities to be active, Cress had gone on a fitness kick. She'd installed all the games with a program that chose from a variety of fitness activities, which she would be required to perform from every time she lost. Though she'd often regretted the program, it did help her keep from becoming cemented to her chair, and she kind of enjoyed the dancing and yoga routines, although she was not looking forward to those jump squats. Just as the twang of a guitar announced the start of the dance, a loud chime delayed the inevitable. Thumbs locked into her pretend belt loops, Cress glanced around at the screens.
Little Cress, what? We have received a direct communication link request from unknown user Mechanic.
Her inside spun as if she'd just done a backflip. Mechanic. With a cry, she half stumbled, half fell toward the smallest screen, hastily tapped in the fitness routine override code, checked the firewall and privacy settings, and saw it. A DCOM request, and the most innocent of questions. Except? Mouth dry, Cress smoothed both palms over her hair.
Yes, except!
The window faded away, replaced with blackness. And then, there he was, Carswell Thorne. He was tilted back in a chair, the heels of his boots propped up in front of the screen. 3 people stood close behind him, but all Cress could see were those blue eyes staring back at her, directly back at her, beginning to fill with the same breathless awe she felt. The same wonder. The same enchantment. Though they were separated by two screens and vast amounts of empty space, she could feel the link being forged between them in that look, a bond that couldn't be broken. Their eyes had met for the first time, and by the look of pure amazement on his face, she knew he felt it too. Heat crept up into her cheeks. Her hands began to shake.
"Aces," Carswell Thorne murmured.
Dropping his feet to the ground, he leaned forward to inspect her closer.
"Is that all hair?"
The bond snapped, the fantasy of one perfect true love moment disintegrating around her. Sudden, overwhelming panic clawed up Cress's throat. With a squeak, she ducked out of view of the camera and scrambled beneath the desk. Her back struck the wall with a thud that rattled her teeth. She crouched there, skin burning hot and pulse thundering as she took in the room before her. The room that he was now seeing too, with the rumpled bed covers and the mustached man on all the screens telling her to grab her imaginary partner and swing them around.
Where'd she go?
Thorne's voice came to her through the screen.
Honestly, Thorne.
A girl. Lynsinder?
Do you ever think before you speak?
What? What did I say?
Is that all hair?
Did you see it? It was like a cross between a magpie nest and a ball of yarn after it's been mauled by a cheetah.
A beat. Then,
a cheetah?
It was the first big cat that came to mind.
Cress hurriedly tried to finger comb the tangles around her ears. Her hair hadn't been cut since she'd been put into the satellite, and now hung past her knees. But Sybil didn't bring sharp objects into the satellite, and Cress had long ago stopped worrying about keeping it neatly braided. After all, who was going to see her?
Oh, to have styled her hair that morning! To have worn the dress that didn't have a hole in the collar.
Had she even brushed her teeth since she'd eaten breakfast? She couldn't remember. And now she was sure that she had bits of spinach from her freeze-dried eggs Florentine stuck between them.
Here, let me speak to her.
Shuffling from the screen.
Hello?
A girl again.
I know you can hear me. I'm sorry my friend is such a wingnut. You can just ignore him.
That's usually what we do,
said the other feminine voice. Cress searched hastily for a mirror, or anything that could pass for one.
We need to talk to you. This is Cinder, the mechanic who fixed the android?
The back of Cress's hand smacked into her clothes hamper. It collided with her wheeled chair, which was launched halfway across the room where it hit the far desk, and sent a half-full cup of water tipping and wobbling. Cress froze, her eyes going wide as the glass teetered toward the memory drive that housed little Cress.
Hello? Is this a good time?
The cup came to rest straight and still once more, not a drop having spilled. Cress slowly exhaled.
This was not how this meeting was supposed to go. This was not the fantasy she'd dreamed up 100 times. What had she said in all those dreams? How had she acted? Who had that person been?
All she could think of was the burning mortification of the country western dancer.
Now face your partner and do-si-do.
And her magpie nest hair, her sweating palms, and her deafening pulse. She squeezed her eyes shut and forced herself to focus, to think. She was not a silly little girl hiding beneath her desk. She was an actress. A gorgeous, poised, talented actress. And she was wearing a sequined dress that sparkled like stars, one that would mesmerize anyone who saw her. She was not one to question her own power to charm those around her, any more than a thaumaturge would question her ability to manipulate a crowd. She was breathtaking. She was
still hiding under the desk.
Are you there?
A snort.
Yeah, this is going really well.
Carswell Thorne. Cress flinched,
but her breaths were becoming less sporadic as she cocooned herself in the fantasy.
"This is a drama set," she whispered, quietly enough that they couldn't hear her.
She forced it into her imagination. This was not her bedroom, her sanctuary, her prison. This was a drama set, with cameras and lights and dozens of directors and producers and android assistants milling about. And she was an actress.
"Little Cress, pause fitness programming."
The screens halted, the room going silent, and Cress crawled out from beneath the desk. Cinder was sitting before the screen now, with Carswell Thorne hovering over her shoulder. Cress glanced at him long enough to catch a smile that was perhaps meant to be apologetic, but only served to make her heart skitter.
"Hi," said Lynn Cinder. "Sorry to surprise you like that. Do you remember me? We spoke a couple of weeks ago on the day of the coronation, and..."
"Yes, of course," she stammered.
Her knees started to shake as she surreptitiously dragged her chair back toward her and sat down.
"I'm glad you're all right."
She forced herself to focus on Lynn Cinder, not on Carswell Thorne. If she only refrained from meeting his gaze again, she would manage. She would not fall apart. And yet, the temptation to fix her eyes on him was still there, tugging at her.
"Oh, thanks," said Linder. "I wasn't sure. I mean, do you follow Earthen news? Do you know what's been happening since..."
"I know everything."
Cinder paused. Cress realized her words had come out all mushed together, and she reminded herself to enunciate when she was playing such a sophisticated role. She forced herself to sit up a bit straighter.
"I follow all the news feeds," she clarified. "I knew you were spotted in France, and I've been tracking your ship, so I knew it hadn't been destroyed. But I still didn't know whether you'd been injured or what had happened, and I've been trying to establish the DCOM link, but you never responded."
She deflated a little, her fingers tying knots into her hair.
"But I am glad to see that you're all right."
"Yes, yes, she's fine. We're fine. Everybody's fine," said Thorne,
perching an elbow on Cinder's shoulder and leaning toward the screen with furrowed brows. Meeting his eyes was unavoidable, and an involuntary squeak slipped past her lips, a sound she'd never heard herself make before.
"Did you just say you've been tracking our ship?"
She opened her mouth, but shut it a moment later when no sound followed. Finally, she managed a brittle nod. Thorne squinted at her as if trying to figure out if she were lying, or merely an idiot. She longed to crawl back beneath the desk.
"Really?" he drawled. "And who do you work for again?"
"You are an actress." "An actress."
"Mistress," she said, forcing the word. "Mistress Sybil. She ordered me to find you, but I haven't told her anything, and I won't. You don't have to worry about that. I've been jamming the radar signals, making sure surveillance satellites are faced the other way when you pass, that sort of thing, so no one else could find you."
She hesitated, realizing that four faces were gaping at her, as if all her hair had just fallen out.
"You must have noticed that you haven't been caught yet."
Lifting an eyebrow, Cinder slid her gaze over to Thorne, who let out a sudden laugh.
"All this time we thought Cinder was casting some witchy spell on the other ships. And it's been you?"
Cinder frowned, but Cress couldn't tell who her annoyance was directed at.
"I guess we owe you a huge thanks."
Cress's shoulders jerked into an uncomfortable shrug.
"It wasn't that difficult. Finding you was the hardest part, but anyone could have figured it out. And sneaking ships around the galaxy is something Lunars have been doing for years."
"I have a price on my head large enough to buy the province of Japan," said Cinder.
"If anyone could have figured it out, they would have by now. So really, thank you."
A blush crept down her neck. Thorne jabbed Cinder in the arm.
"Soften her up with flattery,"
good strategy.
Cinder rolled her eyes. Look, the reason we're contacting you is because we need your help.
Evidently, more than I realized.
Yes, Cress said emphatically, unwrapping the hair from her wrists. Yes, whatever you need.
Thorn beamed. See? Why can't you all be this agreeable?
The second girl smacked him on the shoulder.
She doesn't even know what we want her to do yet.
Cress really looked at her for the first time. She had curly red hair, a collection of freckles over her nose, and curves that were unfairly exaggerated next to Cinder, who was all angles in comparison. The man beside her dwarfed them both and had brown hair that stuck up in every direction, faded scars that hinted at more than his share of scuffles, and a recent bruise on his jaw. Cress tried her best to look confident.
What do you need help with?
When I talked to you before, on the day of the ball, you told me that you've been spying on Earth's leaders and reporting back to Queen Levana. And you also knew that once Levana became Empress, she planned on having Kai assassinated so she could have total control of the Commonwealth and use that power to launch a full-scale attack on the other Earthen countries.
Cress nodded, perhaps too vigorously. Well, we need the people of Earth to know what lengths she's willing to go to in order to stake claim to Earth, not just the Commonwealth. If the other leaders knew that she'd been spying on them all this time, and that she has every intention of invading their countries the first chance she gets, there's no way they would condone this wedding. They wouldn't accept her as a world leader, the wedding would be canceled, and, with any luck, that'll give us a chance to, the ultimate goal is to dethrone her entirely.
Cress licked her lips. So, what do you want me to do?
Evidence. I need evidence of what Levana's planning, of what she's been doing.
Pondering, Cress sank back in her chair. I have copies of all the video surveillance from over the years. It would be easy to pull up some of the most incriminating vids and send them to you over this link.
That's perfect.
It's circumstantial, though. It would only prove that Levana is interested in what the other leaders are doing, not necessarily that she plans on invading them. And I don't think I have any documentation about her wanting to murder His Majesty either. It's largely my own suspicions and speculation on the things my mistress has said.
Well, that's fine. We'll take whatever you have. Levana already attacked us once. I don't think Earthens will take much convincing that she would do it again.
Cress nodded, but her enthusiasm had waned. She cleared her throat. My mistress will recognize the footage. She'll know it was me who gave it to you. Cinder's smile began to fade, and Cress knew she didn't need to clarify her point. She would be killed for her betrayal.
I'm sorry, said Cinder. If there was any way for us to get you away from her, we would, but we can't risk coming to Luna, getting through port security.
I'm not in Luna! The words tumbled out of Cress, coaxed on by a twist of hope.
You don't have to come to Luna. I'm not there.
Cinder scanned the room behind Cress. But you said before that you couldn't contact Earth, so you're not...
I'm on a satellite. I can give you my coordinates, and I checked weeks ago if your Rampian had compatible docking gear, and it does, or at least the pod ships that come standard with it do. You still have the pod ships, right?
You're on a satellite? Said Thorn.
Yes, set to a 16-hour polar orbit around Earth.
How long have you been living in a satellite?
She twisted her hair around her fingers.
7 years or so?
7 years? By yourself?
Yes, she shrugged. Mistress restocks my food and water, and I have net access, so it isn't so bad, but... Well...
But you're a prisoner, said Thorn.
I prefer damsel in distress, she murmured.
One side of Thorn's mouth quirked up into that perfect half-smile he'd had in his graduation photo, a look that was a little bit devious and all sorts of charming.
Cress's heart stopped. But if they noticed her melting into her chair, they didn't say anything. The red-haired girl leaned back, removing herself from the frame, though Cress could still hear her.
It's not like we can do anything that will make Levana want to find us even more than she already does.
Plus, said Cinder, exchanging looks with her companions, do we really want to leave someone in Levana's care who knows how to track our ship?
Cress's fingers began to tingle where her hair was cutting off circulation, but she hardly noticed. Thorn tilted his head and peered at her through the screen.
All right, damsel. Send over those coordinates.
Chapter 6.
Moving on to the dinner service. Her Lunar Majesty did approve the traditional 8-course feast following the ceremony since we last spoke. For that, I suggest we begin with a quartet of sashimi, followed by a light soup, perhaps imitation shark fin soup, which I think would strike a nice balance between old traditions and modern sensibilities.
The wedding planner paused. When neither Kai, who was laid out on his office's sofa with one arm draped across his eyes, nor his chief advisor, Con Torin, offered any objections, she cleared her throat and continued.
For our third course, I thought a nice braised pork belly with green mango relish. That would then lead into our vegetarian entree, for which I recommend portol with poppy seeds on a bed of banana leaves. For the fifth course, I was going to talk to the caterers about some sort of shellfish curry, maybe with a vibrant coconut lime sauce. Does your majesty have any preference on lobster, prawns, or scallops?
Kai peeled his arm off his face, just enough to peer at the wedding coordinator through his fingers. Tashmi Priya must have been well into her 40s, and yet she had the sort of skin that hadn't aged a day past 29. Her hair, on the other hand, was making a slow transition into gray, and he thought it might have accelerated over the past week, as she was the one person in charge of communicating the bride's wishes to the rest of the wedding coordinators. He didn't for a moment underestimate the stress she was under to be working with Queen Levana. Luckily, it seemed to him that she was very, very good at her job. She'd accepted the role of planning the royal wedding without a moment's hesitation, and hadn't balked once at Levana's demands. Her professional perfectionism was evident in every decision she made, even in how she presented herself, with deceptively subtle makeup and not a hair astray. This simplicity was set against a wardrobe of traditional Indian saris, lush silk shot through with jewel tones and complicated embroidery. The combination gave Priya a regal air that Kai knew, at that moment, he was lacking.
Scallops, lobster, he murmured, struggling to pay attention.
Giving up, he covered his eyes again.
No, I have no preference. Whatever Levana wants.
A brief silence before he heard the click of fingernails against her port screen.
Perhaps we'll come back to the feast menu later. As for the ceremony, do you approve of the Queen's choice of Africa's Prime Minister Cayman as your officiant?
I can think of no one more suitable.
Excellent. And have you given any thought to your wedding vows?
Kai snorted. Delete anything that has to do with love, respect, or joy, and I'll sign on the dotted line.
Your Majesty, said Torin,
in that way he had of making the title of respect sound like a chastisement. Sighing, Kai sat up. Torin was in the seat opposite Priya, his hand wrapped around a short glass filled with nothing but ice cubes. He was not normally one to imbibe, which reminded Kai that these were trying times for everyone. He slid his attention back to Priya, whose expression was professionally impassive.
What do you suggest for the vows?
Her eyelids crinkled at the corners, almost apologetically, and he detected something horrible about to come his way.
Her Lunar Majesty has suggested that you write your own vows, Your Majesty.
Oh, stars. He fell back down into the cushions. Please, anything but that.
A hesitation. Would you like me to write them for you, Your Majesty?
Is that in your job description?
Ensuring that this wedding goes smoothly is my job description.
He peered up at the ornate tasseled chandeliers that lined the ceiling. After a complete sweep of the office that had taken his security team a week to complete, they had found a single recording device, smaller than his fingernail, embedded in one of those chandeliers. It was the only device they had found. There was no question that it was Lunar, and that Kai had been right all along. Lavanna was spying on him. His personal quarters had also been swept, though nothing had been discovered there. To date, these were the only rooms where he allowed himself to speak freely about his betrothed, though there was always a warning hum in his head. He really hoped the security detail hadn't missed anything.
Thank you, Taj Mijaya.
I'll think on it.
With a nod, Priya stood. I have an appointment with the caterer this afternoon. I'll see if he has any input on the remaining courses.
Kai forced himself to stand, though the action was surprisingly difficult. The stress of the past weeks had caused him to lose a few pounds, and yet he felt heavier than ever, as if the weight of every person in the Commonwealth were pressing down on him.
Thank you for everything, he said, bowing while she gathered her color swatches and fabric samples.
She returned his bow.
We will speak again in the morning, before Thaumaturge Park's arrival.
He groaned. Is that tomorrow already?
Torn cleared his throat.
I mean, fantastic! He was such a joy to have around the first time.
Priya's smile was fleeting as she slipped out of the door.
Restraining a melodramatic sigh, Kai crumpled back onto the sofa.
He knew he was being childish, but he felt he had the right to lash out occasionally, especially here in the privacy of his own office. Everywhere else, he was expected to smile and proclaim how much he was looking forward to the wedding, how beneficial this alliance would be for the Commonwealth, how he had no doubt that his marriage to Queen Lavanna would serve to unite the people of Earth and Luna in a way that hadn't been seen for centuries and would no doubt lead to greater appreciation and understanding of each other's cultures. It was the first step toward doing away with years of hatred and ignorance and... who on earth did he think he was fooling, anyway?
He hated Lavanna. He hated himself for giving in to her. He hated that his father had managed to keep her and her threats of war at bay for years and years, and within weeks of Kai taking the throne, he'd let everything fall apart. He hated that Queen Lavanna had probably been planning this from the moment it was announced that Emperor Raikon, Kai's father, was ill, and that Kai had played right into her hands. He hated that she was going to win.
The ice in Torin's glass clacked and popped as he leaned forward.
You look pale, Your Majesty. Is there anything I can assist you with? Anything you would like to discuss?
Kai pushed his bangs off his forehead.
Be honest, Torin. Do you think I'm making a mistake?
Torin considered the question for a long moment, before setting the glass aside.
16,000 Earthens were killed when Luna attacked us. 16,000 deaths in only a few hours. That was 11 days ago. I cannot fathom how many lives were spared because of the compromise you made with Queen Lavanna.
He steepled his fingers over his lap.
And we cannot forget how many lives will be saved once we have access to her letamosis antidote.
Kai bit the inside of his cheek. These were the same arguments he'd been repeating to himself. He was doing the right thing. He was saving lives. He was protecting his people.
I know the sacrifice you're making, Your Majesty.
Do you?
His shoulders tensed.
Because I suspect she's going to try to kill me, once she has what she wants, once she's been coronated.
Torin inhaled sharply, but Kai got the impression that this wasn't news to Torin after all.
We won't let that happen. Can we stop it? Your wedding will not be a death sentence. We have time to figure out a way. She still wants an heir, after all.
Kai couldn't stifle a grimace. Very, very small consolation.
I know, but that makes you valuable to her, at least for the time being.
Does it? You know the reputation Lunars have. I'm not sure Lavanna cares one bit who fathers a child, as long as someone does. And wasn't Princess Selene born without anyone knowing who her father was? I'm really not convinced Lavanna needs me for anything other than saying I do and handing her a crown. Much as he hated to admit it, the thought was almost a relief. Torin didn't try to argue against him. He just shook his head.
But the Commonwealth does need you. And they will need you that much more once Lavanna becomes Empress. Your Majesty, I won't let anything happen to you.
Kai recognized an almost fatherly tone. There was affection there, where normally there was only patience and veiled frustration. In some ways, he felt like Torin had become the true Emperor once his father had passed away. Torin was the solid one, the decisive one, the one who always knew what was best for the country. But looking at his advisor now, that impression began to shift. Because Torin had a look that Kai had never seen directed toward himself before. Respect, maybe. Or admiration. Or even trust. He sat up a little straighter.
You're right. The decision has been made, and now I have to make the best of it. Waiting to be trampled under Lavanna's whims won't help anything. I have to figure out how to defend myself against her.
Torin nodded, just shy of a smile.
We will think of something.
For a moment, Kai felt peculiarly bolstered. Torin was not an optimist by nature. If he believed that there was a way, then Kai would believe it too. A way to stay alive, a way to protect his country even after he'd cursed them all with a tyrant for an empress. A way to protect himself from a woman who could control his thoughts with a bat of her lashes. Even as her husband, he would continue to defy Lavanna for as long as he could.
Nancy, Kai's android assistant, appeared in the office doorway, holding a tray with jasmine tea and hot washcloths. Her sensor light flashed.
Daily reports, Your Majesty?
Yes, thank you. Come in.
He took one of the washcloths off the tray as she rolled by, chafing his fingers with the steaming cotton. Nancy set the tray on Kai's desk and turned to face him and Torin, launching into the day's reports that blissfully had nothing to do with wedding vows or eight-course dinners.
Lunar Thaumaturge Amory Park is scheduled to arrive tomorrow at 1500, along with 14 members of the Lunar Court. A list of guest names and titles has been transferred to your port screen. A welcome dinner will commence at 1900, to be followed by evening cocktails. Tajmi Priya will be in attendance at both the dinner and cocktail reception. To begin communicating wedding plans to Thaumaturge Park, we've extended an invitation for Her Lunar Majesty to join us via NetScreen conferencing, but our offer was not accepted.
How disappointing, Kai drawled.
We are expecting a resurgence of protesters outside the palace with the arrival of the Lunar Court, which will likely continue through the date of the wedding ceremony. We have arranged for military reinforcements beginning tomorrow morning to ensure the security of our guests. I will alert you should any protests become violent.
Kai stopped cleaning his hands.
Are we expecting them to be violent?
Negative, Your Majesty. The head of palace security has stated this is only a precaution.
Fine. Go on.
The weekly Letamosis report estimates 30,000 plague-related deaths during the week of 3 September throughout the Commonwealth. The palace research team did not have any progress to report on their ongoing search for an antidote.
Kai traded withering looks with Torin.
30,000 deaths?
It almost made him wish the wedding were tomorrow, so he could get his hands on Lavanna's antidote that much sooner.
Almost.
We have received word that the American Republic, Australia, and the European Federation have all instituted manhunts for the lunar soldiers responsible for the attacks, and claim to be holding multiple suspects as prisoners of war. So far, Luna has not threatened retaliation or made any attempt to bargain for their freedom, other than the previously made agreement that all soldiers will be removed from Earthen soil following the coronation ceremony on the 25th.
Let's hope it stays that way, Kai muttered. The last thing this alliance needs are more political complications.
I will keep you posted on any developments, Your Majesty. The last item to report is that we've received word from Sam Hain Bristol, Parliament Representative from Toronto, East Canada Province, United Kingdom, that he has declined his invitation to attend the wedding ceremony on behalf of his refusal to accept Lunar Queen Levana as a suitable world leader within the Earthen Union.
Torin groaned as Kai rolled his eyes toward the ceiling. Oh, for all the stars. Does he think anyone feels like she would be a suitable leader?
We can't blame him for this position, Your Majesty, said Torin, though Kai could hear the irritation in his tone. Or for wanting to make this statement. He has his own people to be concerned with.
I'm aware of that, but if this starts a trend among the Union leaders, Levana will be livid. Can you imagine her response if no one shows up for the wedding? Kai dragged the now cool washcloth down his face. She'll see this as a personal offense. If we're trying to avoid another attack, I don't think angering her is the way to do it.
I agree, said Torin, standing and adjusting his suit jacket. I will schedule a comm with Bristol Darren and see if we can't come to a compromise. I suggest we keep this information close for the time being, as to avoid giving our other invited guests any wayward ideas.
Thank you, Torin. Kai stood and matched Torin's bow before his advisor slipped out of the office. Kai barely resisted the urge to collapse back on the sofa. He had another meeting in 30 minutes, and there were still plans to review and reports to read and comms to respond to and...
Your Majesty?
He started. Yes, Nancy?
There was one additional report that I thought might be best to discuss with you in private.
He blinked. There were very few subjects that he didn't discuss with Torin. What is it?
An association was recently discovered by my intelligence synapses. It involves Lynn Cinder.
His stomach dropped. It would be that topic. That one topic that he couldn't talk to even his most trusted advisor about. Every time he heard her name, he was filled with barely constrained panic, certain that Cinder had been found. She had been taken into custody. She had already been killed. Even though he should have been glad that his country's most wanted fugitive had been captured, the thought made him ill. What about her? He said, tossing the washcloth back onto the tray and perching on the arm of the sofa.
I may have deduced the reason that she was in Rhea, France.
The tirade of worried thoughts evaporated as quickly as they had come. Sensing a headache, Kai massaged the spot above his nose, relieved that one more hour had come and gone and Cinder was still missing, which meant she was still safe. Rhea, France, he said, reorienting himself. Everyone had known that the ship Cinder was on would need to return to Earth eventually, for fuel and possible maintenance. Her choice of a small town, any small town, had never struck him as suspicious. Go on.
When Lynn Cinder removed the DCOM chip that had temporarily shut down my programming, I transmitted information to her about Michel Benoit.
The pilot? Kai had practically memorized the information Nancy had gathered regarding everyone who had even the most tenuous connection to the missing Princess Celine. Michel Benoit had been one of their top suspects for someone who had possibly helped to hide the princess.
Yes, Your Majesty. Lynn Cinder would have known her name and her previous affiliation with the European military.
So?
After retiring, Michel Benoit purchased a farm. That farm is located near Rio, France, and it was on that property where the stolen ship first landed.
So Cinder went there because... Do you think she was looking for Princess Celine?
That is my assumption, Your Majesty.
He jumped to his feet and began pacing. Has anyone spoken to Michel Benoit? Has she been questioned? Did she see Cinder talk to her?
I am sorry, Your Majesty, but Michel Benoit disappeared over 4 weeks ago.
He stalled. Disappeared?
Her granddaughter, Scarlett Benoit, has gone missing as well. We know only that she boarded a maglev train in Toulouse, France, en route for Paris.
Can't we track them?
Michel Benoit's ID chip was found in her home the day she went missing. Scarlett Benoit's ID chip, it appears, has been destroyed.
Kai slumped. Another dead end. But why would Cinder go there? Why would she care about finding Princess? He hesitated. Unless she's trying to help me.
I cannot follow your reasoning, Your Majesty.
He faced Nancy again. Maybe she's trying to help me. Cinder knows that if she finds the princess, it could be the end of Lavanna's rule. I wouldn't have to marry her. She would probably be executed for treason. Cinder risked her life going to that farm, and she did it. She may have done it for me.
He could hear Nancy's fan whirring before she said, I might suggest the alternate explanation. That Lynn Cinder's motives stem from Queen Lavanna's desire to have her found and executed, Your Majesty.
Face flushing, he dropped his gaze to the hand-woven rug beneath his feet.
Right. Or that.
But he couldn't shake the feeling that Cinder's new objective was about more than self-preservation. After all, she'd come to the ball to warn him against marrying Queen Lavanna. And that decision had nearly gotten her killed.
Do you think she found anything about the princess?
I have no way of discerning that information.
He paced around his desk, staring thoughtfully at the vast city beyond his office window, glass and steel glinting in the afternoon sunlight.
Find out everything you can about this Michel Benoit. Maybe Cinder is onto something. Maybe Princess Celine is still out there.
Hope fluttered again, brightening with every moment. His search for the princess had been abandoned weeks ago, when his life had become too tumultuous to focus on anything other than keeping war at bay, pacifying Queen Lavanna in her temper, preparing himself for a life at her side, as her husband. And that only if he was lucky enough not to be murdered before their first anniversary.
He'd been so distracted that he'd forgotten the reason he'd been searching for Princess Celine in the first place. If she was alive, she would be the rightful heir to the Lunar Throne. She could end Lavanna's reign. She could save them all.
Chapter 7. Dr. Dimitri Erland perched on the edge of his hotel bed, with the worn cotton quilt pooling around his ankles. All his attention was on the battered net screen on the wall, the one where the sound cut out randomly and the picture liked to tremble and flicker at inopportune moments. Unlike the last time a lunar representative had come to Earth, this time the arrival was being internationally broadcast. This time, there was no hiding the purpose of the visit. Her Majesty, the Queen, had gotten what she wanted. She was going to become Empress. Though Queen Lavanna herself would not be arriving until closer to the ceremony date, Thaumaturge Amory Park, as one of her closest lackeys, advisors, was coming early as a show of goodwill to the people of the Commonwealth and planet Earth. That, and to ensure all wedding arrangements were being made to suit Her Majesty's preferences, no doubt. The shimmering white spaceship with its decorative runes had landed on the launch pad of New Beijing Palace 15 minutes ago, and still showed no sign of opening. A journalist from the African Union was droning on and on in the background about
trivial wedding and coronation details. How many diamonds were in the Empress's crown, the length of the aisle, the number of expected guests, and, of course, yet another mention that Prime Minister Kamen herself had been selected as the ceremony's officiant. He was glad for one thing to result from this engagement, at least. All this ballyhoo had taken the media's attention off Miss Cinder. He'd hoped that she would have had the sense to take this serendipitous distraction and come find him, quickly. But that had not yet happened. He was growing impatient, and more than a little worried for the girl, but there was nothing he could do but wait patiently in this forsaken desert and continue with his research and plan for the day when all his hard work would finally come to fruition. Growing bored of the broadcast, Dr. Erland removed his spectacles and spent a moment huffing on them and rubbing them down with his shirt. It seemed that Earthens were quick to forget their prejudices when a royal wedding was involved. Or perhaps they were simply terrified to speak openly about the Lunars and their tyranny. Especially with the memory of the wolf hybrid attack so fresh in the collective memory. Plus, since the announcement of the royal engagement, at least two members of the worldwide media who had declared the alliance a royal mistake, a Net Group administrator from Bucharest on the Sea and a newsfeed editor from Buenos Aires, had committed suicide. Which, Dr. Erlan suspected, was a diplomatic way of saying, murdered by Lunars, but who can prove it? Everyone was thinking the same thing, regardless of whether or not they would say it. Queen Levana was a murderer. And a tyrant, and this wedding was going to ruin them. But all his anger was eschewed by the knowledge that he was a hypocrite. Levana was a murderer? Well, he had helped her become one. It had been years, a lifetime, it seemed, since he was one of the leading scientists on Luna's genetic engineering research team. He had spearheaded some of their greatest breakthroughs, back when Channery was still queen, before Levana took over, before his crescent moon was murdered, before Princess Selene was stolen away to Earth. He was the first to successfully integrate the genetics from an Arctic wolf with those of a 10-year-old boy, giving him not only many of the physical abilities that they'd already perfected, but the brutal instincts of the beast as well. Some nights, he still dreamed of that boy's howls in the darkness. Erland shivered. Pulling the blanket over his legs, he turned back to the broadcast. Finally, the space door lifted. The world watched as the ramp hit the platform. A gaggle of lunar nobility arose from the ship first, bedecked in vibrant silks and flowing chiffons and veiled headdresses. Always with the veiled headdresses. It had become quite the trend during Queen Channery's rule, who, like her sister, refused to reveal her true face in public. Erland found himself leaning closer toward the screen, wondering if he could identify any of his long-ago peers beneath their cloaks. He had no luck. Too many years had passed, and there was a good chance that all those telling details he'd memorized were glamour created anyway. He himself had always given off the illusion of being much taller when he was surrounded by the narcissistic lunar court. The guards were next, followed by five third-tier thaumaturges, donning their embroidered black coats. They were all handsome, without any glamours, as the queen preferred, though he suspected that few of them had been born with such natural good looks. Many of his co-workers on Lunar had made lucrative side businesses offering plastic surgery, melatonin adjustments, and body reconstruction to thaumaturge and royal guard hopefuls. In fact, he'd always been fond of the rumor that Sybil Mira's cheekbones were made out of recycled plumbing pipes. Thaumaturge Amory came last, looking as relaxed and smug as ever in the rich crimson jacket that so well complemented his dark skin. He approached the waiting Emperor Cato and his convoy of advisors and chairmen, and they shared a mutually respectful bow.
Dr. Erland shook his head.
Poor young Emperor Kai. He had certainly been thrown to the lions during his short reign, hadn't he?
A timid knock rattled the door, making Dr. Erland jump. Look at him, wasting his time with lunar processions and royal alliances that, with any luck, would never be realized. If only Lin Cinder would stop gallivanting about Earth and space and start following directions for once. He stood and shut off the net screen. All this worrying was going to give him an ulcer. In the hallway was a squirrely boy who couldn't have been more than 12 or 13, with dark hair cut short and uneven. His shorts hung past his knees and were frayed at the hems, and his sandaled feet were coated in the fine sand that covered everything in this town. He was holding himself too tall, like he was trying to give the impression that he wasn't at all nervous, not one little bit.
"I have a camel for sale. I heard you might be interested."
His voice trembled on the last word. Dr. Erlon dropped his spectacles to the end of his nose. The boy was scrawny, sure, but he didn't appear malnourished. His dark skin looked healthy, his eyes bright and alert. Another year or so, and Dr. Erlon suspected he'd be the taller of the two of them.
"One hump or two?" he asked.
"Two,"
the boy took in a deep breath.
"And it never spits."
Erlon tilted his head. He had to be careful about who he told this code language to. But news seemed to be spreading quickly, even into neighboring oasis towns. It was becoming common knowledge that the crazy old doctor was looking for lunars who would be willing to help him with some experimentation, and that he could pay them for their assistance. Of course, the spreading knowledge of his semi-celebrity status, complete with Commonwealth want ads, hadn't hurt either. He thought many people who came to knock on his door were merely curious about the lunar who had infiltrated the staff of a real earthen palace, and who had helped the true celebrity, Lin Cinder, escape from prison. He would have preferred anonymity, but this did seem to be an effective method for gathering new test subjects, which he needed if he was ever going to copy the letamosis antidote the lunar scientists had discovered.
"Come in," he said,
stepping back into the room, without waiting to see if the boy followed. He opened the closet that he had transformed into his own mini laboratory. Vials, test tubes, petri dishes, syringes, scanners, an assortment of chemicals, all neatly labeled.
"I can't pay you in univs,"
he said, pulling on a pair of latex gloves.
"Barter only. What do you need? Food? Water? Clothing? Or if you're willing to wait on payment for 6 consecutive samples, I can arrange one-way transportation into Europe. No documentation required."
He opened a drawer and removed a needle from the sterilizing fluid.
"What about medication?"
He glanced back. The boy had barely taken 2 steps into the room.
"Shut the door before you let in all the flies," he said.
The boy did as he was told, but his focus was now caught on the needle.
"Why do you want medicine? Are you sick?"
"For my brother."
"Also Luna."
The boy's eyes widened. They always did when Dr. Erland threw out the words so casually. But he never understood why. He only asked for lunars. Only lunars ever knocked on his door.
"Stop looking so skittish," Dr. Erland grumbled. "You must know that I'm Luna too."
He did a quick glamour to prove himself, an easy manipulation so that the boy perceived him as a younger version of himself, but only for an instant. Though he'd been tampering with bioelectricity more freely since he'd arrived in Africa, he found that it drained him more and more. His mind simply wasn't as strong as it used to be, and it had been years since he'd had any consistent practice. Nevertheless, the glamour did its job. The boy's stance relaxed, now that he was somewhat sure that Dr. Erland wouldn't have him and his family sent to the moon for execution. He still didn't come any closer, though.
"Yes," he said. My brother is lunar too, but he's a shell.
This time, it was Erlan's eyes that widened.
A shell? Now that had true value. Though many lunars came to Earth in order to protect their non-gifted children, tracking those children down had proven more difficult than Erland had expected. They blended in too well with Earthans, and they had no desire to give up their disguise. He wondered if half of them were even aware of their own ancestry.
How old? He said, setting the syringe down on the counter. I would pay double for a sample from him.
At Erland's sudden eagerness, the boy took a step back.
7, he said. But he's sick.
With what? I have painkillers, blood thinners, antibiotics.
He has the plague, sir. Do you have medicine for that?
Dr. Erland frowned.
Letemosis? No. No, that is impossible. Tell me his symptoms. We'll figure out what he really has.
The boy looked annoyed at being told he was wrong, but not without a tinge of hope.
Yesterday afternoon, he started getting a bad rash with bruises all over his arms, like he'd been in a brawl. Except he hadn't. When he woke up this morning, he was hot to the touch, but he kept saying he was freezing, even in this heat. When our mother checked, the skin under his fingernails had gone bluish, just like the plague.
Erland held up a hand.
You say he got the spots yesterday, and his fingers were already turning blue this morning.
The boy nodded.
Also, right before I came here, all those spots were blistering up like blood blisters.
He cringed. Alarm stirred inside the doctor as his mind searched for an explanation. The first symptoms did sound like letemosis, but he'd never heard of it moving through its 4 stages so quickly. And the rash becoming blood blisters? He'd never seen that before. He didn't want to think of the possibility, and yet it was also something he'd been waiting for years to happen. Something he'd been expecting. Something he'd been dreading. If what this boy said was true, if his brother did have letemosis, then it could mean that the disease was mutating. And if even a lunar was showing symptoms. Erland grabbed his hat off the desk and pulled it on over his balding head.
Take me to him.